Welcome to Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia. Our guest today is Paula Kerger, President and CEO of PBS. Her commitment to quality programming and the use of new technology has resulted in a broad range of initiatives and national acclaim. She's been included on the Hollywood Reporter's Women in Entertainment Power 100 list for the past 8 years and is the recipient of numerous honors and awards. We'll talk with her about the latest developments at PBS, about the importance of the PBS mission in our communities, and about PBS after Downton Abbey. Paula Kerger, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you.
Before we talk about PBS, I want to find out a little bit about you. You took the reins of PBS in 2006, becoming the sixth and the longest serving president of PBS since it succeeded National Education Television in 1970. Tell us a little bit about the career path that led you to lead PBS.
I talk to a lot of young people about career paths, and I think for me, it was not a deliberately plotted out adventure. But I often think that everything that I did in my life clearly was leading me to this place, beginning with the fact that my grandfather was in Baltimore, was part of a group that created the public radio station there. He was a professor and had this idea that a radio station could provide a real-world experience for his students. And so, you know, public media, I think, started in my formation. And of course, I remember watching public media as a child, but I came into public media really as someone who's worked her entire career in the nonprofit world. And I came into public broadcasting about 25 years ago, working in a station in New York. I first was involved in development and helping putting the resources together, helping them set up an endowment. And from there became the station manager and became more and more involved in the actual management of the station, the running of the station.
WNET, you're referring to?
At WNET, Channel 13, for anyone that lived in New York knows Channel 13. And I was in that job, actually, when I got a call one day asking if I would consider putting my hat in the ring to be the CEO of PBS. And it was a period of great transition. I felt at the time that although I loved my job in New York and actually had no intention of leaving, I thought that it was going to be an important moment for public broadcasting, and I thought it was important that the next leader of public broadcasting actually come from one of the stations. That my two predecessors didn't have that experience, and they brought a lot to PBS, but they also had some unique challenges, and I thought at least I could, in my work working with stations, be able to speak from a place where they all were, which is that I'd walked in their shoes and understood at a very fundamental level some of the challenges that they were facing, and that I think actually has served me well.
You talked about your grandfather and the role he played in the development of public radio. Actually, Pennsylvania played a significant role in the development of public broadcasting.
Right. In fact, it's here, you know, at Penn State was always, if you look back in the history, has always been involved in really looking at media as a way of extending education and information beyond the community to, you know, some of its early days using broadcast as a way of extending. And actually the station itself was first called PSX, and X stood for extend the work of Penn State out to a broader community. But most people don't realize that actually at the Nittany Lion Hotel is where the then FCC commissioner announced that spectrum was going to be set aside for educational purposes. It was really the first moment that it was discussed that there would be educational television, and that happened right here. And it happened right here 63 years ago, almost to the day that we're sitting here having this conversation. So I think that's pretty special. I like to think of this as being really the cradle of public broadcasting, and it happened right here on this campus.
I'm going to talk a little bit about how you make all of this happen, because you've jokingly talked about your job as akin to herding cats.
Mm-hmm.
There are 354 independently owned and operated member stations. And we're not talking about a restaurant franchise where they're all alike. They're all very, very different.
They're all profoundly different. I mean, this is in many ways the most American of institutions, because we are very local Every station is independent. It is owned by the people in the community. In some cases, as is the case here, the station is part of Penn State. In other parts of the country, my old station was part of the community. It had a community board. Some of our stations are part of the state. And each station grew up in a community, put on the air by people in that community with the express purpose of being able to share ideas and be educational media, different than commercial media. And so all of those stations together created PBS. I remember when I was first hired to run PBS, people congratulated me and said, oh, you're going to run all these 350 stations. I said, no, you have that backwards. They run me. but the stations came together to create PBS with this whole idea that there would be an opportunity that you could create at scale if stations came together to collaborate, where you could create programs like The News Hour and Sesame Street and could empower filmmakers like Ken Burns that one individual station wouldn't be able to do on its own. So there is a social contract between our stations that we not only support to create this collective, but that we also agree that we'll do a lot of things the same. So in most parts of the country, you'll find Masterpiece on Sunday nights, you'll find Nova and Nature on Wednesday nights and so forth. But each station makes its own decisions of what ends up on the air. Ultimately, every station makes that decision independently. And so my job is to help the stations together form a sense of collective vision and purpose. And so with agreement that we're going to move more or less in the same direction, we can accomplish great things together, but with also the flexibility and power of being also very local and very bespoke.
In fact, you talk about it as if PBS is to thrive, it's collective identity that
right.
will allow it to do that.
Right.
So I'm wondering just how disruptive is it when a station says, I'm going to move documentaries off the main channel and onto another part of our program, our service.
Yeah, so we're navigating through that exact issue right now. I think that one of the things that is challenging is to try to figure out ways that we make sure that stations have enough flexibility. And in this circumstance, the station that was interested in finding another home for documentaries, another time schedule, is that they also wanted to serve another of their audiences, which is the arts. We have a very deep commitment in public media to be a home for the arts. We want to give every American a front row seat to the greatest performances. And I don't mean that by just Broadway or just the big splashy performing arts programs. We do programs here. We did a profile of the Pennsylvania Ballet that was aired nationally. We did a program on the movement of the Barnes to downtown Philadelphia. It's just two examples that are actually a little closer to home here. Figuring out how to accommodate all of that is really a challenge. And so we spent a lot of time talking to filmmakers, talking to the stations, really trying to figure out, and I think we're now on the other side of really making a commitment that yes, we're all going to get together behind independent film, but it's not just about a single night of the week. It's also how do we look for ways that we're promoting independent film online? How do we look for ways that we're really showcasing independent film in all the other places where our content is located, whether it's Roku or Apple TV or others? And how do we look for ways that we can partner with independent film festivals and independent filmmakers at the local level as well as nationally to really make the impact of the programming that we do so much larger than just putting it up on the schedule and hoping that people will find it? And so through a lot of dialogue, which believe me, no commercial organization would do. They'd make a move and people would be upset and they'd say, oh, this was a business decision, and we'd go on. But we really listen. And we really try to figure out how do you accommodate the difference between what we'd like to do collectively with what a local station might do to be able to really create a solution where everyone wins.
This is a question I have to ask because so many people have been reintroduced to public broadcasting and have renewed their support for it because of something like Downton Abbey, which really has put Masterpiece Theater back on the map and back in the black. We've all heard that this sixth season will be its final one. What has Downton Abbey meant to the service, and what do you envision as life after Downton Abbey?
Yeah, it's a really great question too, because I think that Downton Abbey, and most people when they talk to me about Downton Abbey believe, oh, this is such a great and important series because so many people love it. It's obviously bringing in a great audience. I love the fact that it's actually bringing in a multi-generational audience. A lot of times when I talk to people about Downton Abbey, they say that, you know, they love the series, but what they also really love is the fact that it's a program that you can watch with your children and grandchildren, and it really does bring people together. And it's one of those handful of programs, I think, that are on television now that are truly water cooler type of programs, right? People know that they can watch Downton Abbey many different ways. They can get the DVDs or they can watch it later, but a lot of people work really hard to be home on Sunday nights to watch Downton because they want to be able to talk about it. It's very much a program that you want to be able to share and discuss. But for our system, for public media system, it has been so profoundly important because I think we have great programs that we can point to as part of our heritage, but those moments of programs, whether it's on public television or commercial television, that truly pop, that everyone talks about, those are increasingly fleeting. And I think that for a lot of people, it was the belief that perhaps those days are behind us, that we would never have another program like an Upstairs, Downstairs that would have
Anne of Green Gables.
Anne of Green Gables that would have that same sort of energy around it. And so Downton Abbey is a powerful reminder that, yes, those moments do continue to happen and that we should continue to look for them. So, so we have another season ahead, so I'm not yet talking about the end of Downton Abbey because we still have one more year. But we are thinking about, and what we've invested in, is a lot of drama, because there's really great drama actually on television, commercial television, cable,
and not
and
just
on public
British
television.
Drama.
And not just British drama. So we're producing a drama right now. We're shooting it outside of Richmond. It's called Mercy Street. It's a powerful Civil War series that really talks about the birth of emergency medicine. It's based on a true story that happened in Alexandria. Alexandria was a city that was certainly below the Mason-Dixon line, but was controlled by the Union. And the hotel in Alexandria that was converted into a military hospital had both Union and Confederate nurses. And it is really a very powerful story that's a very much an American story, you know. And so we're really excited to bring that forward. We have Indian Summer coming up, which for those that love Jewel and the Crown is very much in that spirit. It takes place during the Raj. So we're looking, and we have Sherlock coming back. And so in the same year that Downton joined public broadcasting, a then unknown Benedict Cumberbatch was also sort of burst on the scene as a very new kind of Sherlock, and we're shooting right now the newest of the Sherlock. So we have a lot of good things in the pipeline with Downton Abbey in the short term and longer term, expanding on that legacy.
PBS is sometimes jokingly referred to as primarily British series because there are so many British programs. I'm kind of curious to know what the balance is. Is the BBC airing many American programs that they get from PBS?
I think people see a lot of British programming because that's what a lot of the drama is on public broadcasting. But, you know, sort of in aggregate, the lion's share of our programming is not British. We tend to have more British drama because drama is very expensive to produce, and we have a limited budget. Our entire content budget is actually smaller than what an HBO would spend on the promotion of a new series. So that just gives you some sense of scale. So we really do need to look for ways that we can leverage the investments that we make, and there's wonderful British co-productions, and that's where we've done that. We actually have, in the course of the last couple years, we started an effort, actually it was through philanthropy. A donor gave us the resources to start a PBS channel in the UK as really a way for us to bring great American stories to a British audience.
So there's BBS America.
So there's PBS
and
America.
PBS
and
America.
I feel very strongly that that's important because so much of what comes from the United States that is brought to the UK as entertainment is really built on Hollywood, some of the reality shows and so forth, and I'm not sure that really describes America well. I've always felt that if we could create a home for Ken Burns, I had the privilege of being in the UK last fall before the broadcast of the Roosevelts, and people were really excited about that program coming to the UK, and I think that's a better representative of the United States than Honey Boo Boo.
You know, yes, you mentioned Roku a moment ago, and all of the various platforms that PBS content is now available. How concerned are you that while people consume this content that's now available exclusively on the web, not even made for television, that people will associate it with PBS and then support it?
Well, brand is really important. And so one of the things that we focused on very specifically, because there's a glut of material everywhere. And so how do people find content and how do they make good content decisions? And one of the things that I think we have worked very carefully in conjunction with our stations is really focusing on the value of that brand, which I think stands for programming that is authentic. You know that it's going to be engaging and educational, hopefully inspiring when we really hit our mark. And so we've been pretty relentless in looking for ways on all of these different platforms, not to just create a space for PBS, but to create a space for WPSU as well and for our local stations. And so we've built everything off of the same sort of backbone where we are not only bringing Ken Burns' work to these platforms, but also WPSU's work as well. So if you have the app, or if you have an Apple TV, or if you have a Roku, you know, when you sign up, you have to localize it and you pick your station. If you go online to pbs.org, the first thing that pops up is pick your station. And so the reason that you're doing that is that it's constantly connecting you back. I think that as stations and as a system, we have to be mindful of the fact that a lot of people will continue to go to television, but a lot of people are also looking for us in different places. And I think that we all learned a lesson from the record industry some years ago that if you force people to do what you want them to do, in the case of the record industry, buy albums versus buy songs, or in our case, if you force them to go to hear on a broadcast channel rather than looking at various places, people will pass you by. And so I think we want to make sure that we are there in all those places, but that we're constantly pointing back to the channel as well, so that you have a WPSU experience on the tablet, but you also are reminded of the breadth of programming also on the channel as well. And I think if we're really conscious about that, we'll be successful. And we saw it in the fall with the Roosevelts, Ken Burns series.
You said 33.5 million Americans
watched. They also went online and streamed, and they went back and watched. So we see how people are flowing back and forth. So people aren't going one place versus another. They're in all places, and I think we just need to reinforce that.
If you're just joining us, this is Take Note on WPSU. I'm Patty Satalia, and our guest is Paula Kerger, President and CEO of PBS.
One interesting thing that PBS is doing is the PBS Digital Studios, and one of the first phenomenal hits, although it's not what you're all about, was an auto-tuned remix of Mr. Rogers'
yeah.
The Garden
of Your Mind, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which
it was
went viral.
It went viral, and it was, you know, it was an experiment. So we created this space, Digital Studios, as a way to begin working with people who were working in YouTube to try to look at how we could take their storytelling, you know, these are people that really have sort of PBS DNA, that's how I always like to think of it, how we could bring their storytelling under a PBS umbrella and really begin to experiment on those kind of platforms. And so the very first thing we did was the autotune with Fred Rogers. And
which is marvelous.
It was crazy. I mean, we put it up, it immediately went viral. If you got it in your head, it sort of stuck there. It's now in my head, so I'm not sure whether I should be thanking you or cursing you. And people talked about it. You know, if you looked at the comments, they were really tapping into their own experiences.
And how much they loved Fred Rogers.
It very much tied into Fred Rogers. And we were getting ready to launch Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood, which was a new kids series based on Fred Rogers' teachings. And so it all became this sort of beautiful conversation about what he was trying to instill in young people, that every individual matters, and that, and really helping people have the confidence, you know, exploring the world in their own way and so forth. It was terrific. And from that, we jumped off to something called the Idea Channel, which was really about taking lots of interesting ideas all juxtaposed and getting people interested about, you know, different topics, all very quick cut paste. And then with viewer comment, again, folded in. And it really became the beginning of what has become a continual rollout of series. We have about 80 series up now, Blank on Blank, which are audio recordings of these really great interviews, all then set to animation. And you really focus on conversation and what people are talking about. One of the very early ones was really talking about, you know, early jazz tours behind the Iron Curtain and how jazz was part of what really got people thinking about very different topics that were not related to music at all. I mean, it's just, it's great content and great material presented in a different way. None of these things, by the way, would work in television, but very much at the heart of what public television tries to do, or PBS has always tried to do, which is to really share interesting ideas and create conversation.
You say one of the things that PBS needs to do in addition to helping increase literacy and reading among children, for example, is develop emotional intelligence.
Right.
Which is something Mr. Rogers, Fred Rogers, did beautifully.
Right.
So explain how PBS is working towards that end.
So we have a wonderful children's producer, Angela Santomero. She created Super Y, and she was always inspired by Fred Rogers. In fact, she had an opportunity to work with him for a while. And so she had this idea of what if we could reimagine what Fred Rogers produced. Now, obviously, he's passed away, and you want to be able to pay tribute to what he was doing, but also to sort of reimagine it for a contemporary audience. And so her idea was creating Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood. And the whole spirit of Daniel Tiger, who, by the way, is an animated character, wears a little red sweater. And there are so many elements. So parents who remember Fred Rogers will see elements of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood in Daniel Tiger. But, you know, helping children master some of the basic social-emotional skills of dealing with your emotions, dealing with disappointment, paying attention, all of those things. One very popular episode was helping Daniel deal with the arrival of a new baby sister, Margaret, and what that meant when you were no longer the only child. And all of these have been so popular because parents really do struggle to how they teach their children these skills. And these are the fundamental skills that if you talk to anyone involved in early childhood education, say, are so critically important and often are the difference between whether a child actually masters skill in school or whether they just languish behind because they can't pay attention in class.
You mentioned earlier your two predecessors, Pat Mitchell and Irvin Dugan, and he said something that I wanted to run past you because he left after 5 years, and he said it was because of the wear and tear. He said living in an intensely political atmosphere where PBS was treated often as a political football. And then he also talked about the constant temptation in the system to imitate the commercial TV industry, to run commercials, to do programming that is designed to attract big audiences rather than be true to our public service mission. And I'm wondering how great that struggle is today.
Well, I think there's always a tension in a media organization, and we talk about this a lot within our system, you know, because we are mass media, so we do want to reach an audience, and particularly for children, I really do care how many children we reach, because the content that we're producing is not because I'm trying to sell soda pop to kids, which is someone else's business. What I am trying to do is to make sure that every child has access to content that is really going to expand their mind and really help them, particularly as they get ready to enter school, you know, with these basic skills. And so you need to develop programs that children will want to watch, but that also have the curriculum embedded in it. With the content for adults, it's the same thing. I really do want to find programming that is different and unique and is important. But I also want to make sure that, you know, we're reaching more than five people, right? You know, we don't let ratings rule what we do. I mean, we would make very different decisions. You would see different types of programs on every night if that was the case. But what I do want to do is very much a balance. So there are programs in the schedule that I know when we put them on probably aren't going to get a really big audience, but for the audience that are coming, it's going to be a very important program. And so it's that constant balance that we have to pay attention to. So I think Irv's comments are really important, that it is always attention and it is always really paying attention to not going down that slippery slope of just picking programs just because you know they're going to be popular, but really that blend of programs that have wider audience appeal. It's the Downton Abbey, which I'm very proud of. It's the Front Lines, which I'm enormously proud of. It's that documentary film that is on an impactful subject. All of that is part and parcel of the whole fabric of what we're bringing to the American public as part of PBS.
In December 2009, PBS for the first time started to participate in the Nielsen ratings. Why'd you do that, and what does it mean?
Well, our producers always, we looked at ratings, and so it's not as if we didn't know what our audiences were. But beginning in 2009, we really made more of an effort to try to drill down and understand who was watching. Not that we would be driven by ratings, because I think that when people first heard, they were a little concerned. But a couple things. One is, we do want to understand that if we're producing a program, is it connecting? And so we want to understand sort of in the larger sense what kind of audience is coming in, but are we also reaching the audiences we hope? So, we're service for the American public. We want to make sure that we're reaching the breadth of the public. The second thing is that we do have funders, foundations and others that support our programs, and increasingly they actually are asking the question, well, we've helped you create these programs. Did anyone watch? Did it make a difference? And so being able to look at whether people are coming or not is important. And then the third is I'm also interested in, are we actually making it easy for people to find the work that we're producing? And so by looking at the audiences, so are people coming to Nature and then staying for NOVA and then staying for the science programs, being able to actually look at the audiences was helpful to be able to figure out whether in fact that strategy was effective, which in fact it is.
You mentioned the NewsHour just a bit ago, and a couple of years ago, Sarah Just took over as producer. Of course, she comes from commercial ABC. Network news. One of the things she said she was going to do was speed up the metabolism in the newsroom. How is the newsroom doing now that you have Nielsen ratings to really tell you what's happening?
Well, I think what she's done, she's fairly new in the job, but we're just starting to see the impact that she's had is, and she had a really interesting, take on it because she loves the NewsHour. That's why she was interested in coming to work with us.
From ABC.
And from ABC. And what she wanted to be able to do was really keep what makes the NewsHour so important and powerful, but to also move from being so heavily studio-based discussion to a little bit more field pieces and to really add a little bit of a lift to some of the pacing of the program so that it really does feel very lively and engaged. So she was concerned, as all of us have been, with what's happened in commercial media, with the types of stories that are being produced and so forth, and the opportunity to be involved in such a important news service and to be able to bring more reporting, frankly, from outside the Beltway into the NewsHour is what she's tried to do, and the audiences have increased. So
it's working.
Yeah, she's definitely doing great work.
What have you done in the last 9 years for which you are most proud, and what most importantly do you want to do while you're leading PBS?
Obviously, I'm really proud of any program that comes through that really has impact and makes a difference. I'm really proud of the fact that we're spending more time focusing on the arts. I think a society is really defined by the great art it creates, and I think helping people connect to that is important, particularly as I look at what's happened in arts education in schools. I'm really proud of the fact that our system as a whole really has, I think, come together in a way that is very powerful. Every station is individual, but I think for the most part, people do agree amongst what are the important objectives. And I'm really proud that we've taken the risk in the digital space. I look at industries that have held back because something has worked for years, and I think the fact that we're able to take risk and agree that this is going to move us forward, I'm really proud of that. These have been really challenging and such interesting years, and when you look back over the history of public broadcasting, we're at a place very similar to the beginning days.
And with just a couple of seconds, how optimistic are you of the future of public broadcasting?
Oh, I'm hugely optimistic. I think, in 2 years we've gone from the 12th most watched broadcaster to 5th, and at a time when media competition has never been more acute. We are expanding on all different platforms. I think people hunger for the kind of content that we produce. And I think that as long as we're not faint of heart and we're willing to continue to push, as long as we don't lose our guide star, which is quality content, I think we've got a really bright future ahead of us, and it's exciting.
All right, Paula Kerger, thank you so much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
That was Paula Kerger, President and CEO of PBS. To hear more of this interview, check the links on our website, wpsu.org/take note. I'm Patty Satalia, WPSU.